thanks so much for joining me today on the Cocked Eye Podcast. I'm your host, Gary. In case you're new to the show, I'm the editor and chief collation officer here at fortnerd.com. What? You gotta keep files organized even if you live in a fort? You may have seen me as DM for Quest for the Cure, or on Icehole's Rime of the Frostmaiden, as Cicero on Cyberpunk Independence, as Doc on Scribes and Scrolls, or sailing on the SS Failboat over at Talon and Claw. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to the show, or follow me on social media at fortnerd.com. That's at fortnerd, D-O-T-C-O-M. Or both. Both works for me, but whatever works for you is fine. There's a bunch I want to talk about, so let's get into it. We've got some official D&D leaks, and they're pretty big. Amazon dropped the titles for the next two D&D releases. The Wild Beyond the Witchlight, a Feywild adventure, is scheduled for September 21st, and Strixhaven, Curriculum of Chaos, releases on November 16th. Both books will get tons of spoilers dropped during D&D Live 2021 on July 16th and July 17th, including new character options, monsters, mechanics, adventure hooks, and more. We know that the Wild Beyond the Witchlight is also getting an accessory kit. We've talked about these in the past, and while we can't confirm for sure, it sure looks to be similar to the accessory kits that accompanied Avernus and Frostmaiden. It will likely be a deluxe set of dice, maps, and cards that support the new adventure. We also know that Wild Beyond the Witchlight will support characters from level 1 to 8. The description from the back of the book is released too. Here it is. Once, every 8 years, the fantastic Witchlight Carnival touches down on your world, bringing joy to one settlement after the next. Its owners, Mr. Witch and Mr. Light, know how to put on a good show. But there's more to this magical extravaganza than meets the eye. The carnival is a gateway to a fantastic Feywild domain, unlike anything found on the material plane. Time has not been kind to this realm, however, and dark days lie ahead, unless someone can thwart the Hourglass Coven. The Wild Beyond the Witchlight will take adventurers from the Witchlight Carnival to Prismere, a Feywild domain of delight. The book comes with a poster map and shows the carnival on one side and Prismere on the other. The Feywild races of Fairy, Owlfolk, Hobgoblin of the Feywild, and Rabbitfolk dropped in an Unearthed Arcana supplement. At that time, we have rhetorically suggested it could signal a visit to the plane in an upcoming sourcebook. And we were right. Like the Dampier, Reborn, and Hexblood, the Unearthed Arcana races led directly to a new sourcebook. Given that the Draconic races dropped a few months ago, it suggests a Dragonlance book may be dropping in D&D's March release window. We'll see. Can't confirm, but it does seem likely. The strategic leaks we're seeing on new releases is likely going to continue, especially as the cadence of D&D books increases. More D&D is better, though, so bring it on. We don't know much about Strixhaven, Curriculum of Chaos, but we do know that Strixhaven is a Magic the Gathering setting, so is another D&D Magic the Gathering crossover. Did you know that you can win a seat to join Ed Greenwood, Blair Brown, Emma Wakelin, Eric Morden, and Amy Lynn DeZura in a game of Dungeons & Dragons? That's right, you can win a seat to join us for Quest for the Cure. For a contribution of $25, you're entered to win. In fact, for every $25 you contribute to our quest, you get a chance to win. Donate $100 and you get 4 chances. Curtis, Philip, and Todd, previous winners, have really enjoyed the experience, and I think you will too. But you can only win if you contribute to our quest to defeat Duchenne. You can learn more at jessiesjourney.com/questforthecure. Today, my amazing guest is Ginny Loveday. She's the host of the Designer's Den on Twitch and the D&D Roundtable podcast. She's a DM's Guild adept and best-selling author of a multitude of D&D projects. She does community management for Baldman Games and D&D Virtual Weekends and is a driving force behind the Mayday's 10-day online charity convention, supporting a host of wonderful causes. To say Ginny is busy is an understatement of epic proportions. I'm so grateful she took the time to chat with me about D&D, organized play, and game design. I hope you enjoy my interview with Ginny Loveday. Hey, Ginny, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Gary. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, so I like to start with the same question for most of my guests, because I'm always very interested in their origin stories with Dungeons and Dragons, because most of the people that I'm talking to are very heavily invested in the game. Yes. So what was your first experience with D&D?
So my first experience playing D&D, I was actually in college, didn't get started till late. And I actually didn't know I was going to play D&D. My friend just invited me to play a game and I was like, yeah, sure, I'm in. Then we get there and she's explaining, you know, she's going to run a campaign and we're going to do this. And we ended up running a fourth edition campaign. And despite my feelings on fourth edition in general, it was a lot of fun. Did that for a while, then played a little bit of third edition 3.5, and then fifth edition came around and, well, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I dove in head first.
Anybody who's taken a look at your writing credits on RPG Geek recognizes that immediately. Do you have any memories of that first game? Was there anything in that first fourth edition game that your friend was running that sort of sucked you in, or was it something that came later? What locked you into D&D?
Well, I mean, D&D is typical fantasy, and I've always enjoyed that. Like, even though role-playing games weren't a thing where I grew up, very rural South, you know, once I got into D&D, it's like, okay, it's the same stories that I love, but now I'm the story. So that was really like, you know, hook, line, and sinker. But I do remember the first campaign. We had all started in Om, and we had all been kicked out of various merchant houses for whatever reasons. And so we were just trying to make our way through the world. And I was playing an Eladrin. What class was I? Sword Mage? Wait, is that the name of the class? Yes, something like that. Okay. And my partner at the time was playing a bugbear rogue, and my favorite part of this was like he's a min-maxer, so this was the sneakiest bugbear that ever existed, and so like we had to come up with all of these like over the top reasons for why people didn't notice him. Like, okay, so you picked up the tree and you're just like walking it across the field and then you sit down again. And it was just a really good experience. It was a couple of my, you know, close friends from college, and really just kind of like a bonding experience. And we really just kind of, poor Katie, I feel bad for her because we just went wherever.
Yeah.
And she just had to go with the flow.
Yeah. The amazing thing about, maybe it's not the amazing thing, is whenever I'm asking that question, by and large, it's a very positive experience. I've actually had only one guest, or maybe two, whose experience with D&D wasn't overwhelmingly positive, but they sort of stuck with it, or they came to it a different way. Maybe they were introduced in childhood and they picked it up again in college like you did. But that sort of positive experience, regardless of they had these positive memories of the game, I find that really, really telling about bringing people into the game.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the fact that D&D is such a social experience is really appealing to a lot of people. Like, even if maybe like the first game you play wasn't like your DM wasn't the hottest or whatever, like you still remember sitting around the table and just having fun with your friends. And like that kind of puts the rose tinted glasses over the rest of it. You're like, yeah, I remember it being great. And then one of your, you know, co-players at the table, that session sucked. You're like, did it? Oh, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. It's that the ability to actually sit around and hang out with people is, I mean, obviously we're not doing it now, but we're making the best of it.
Working on it.
So, Ginny, you're active both as a community organizer, as a writer, a podcaster. I want to talk about your community organizing first. How did you get into organizing, doing community organizing? And by that, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's organizing events, hosting conventions, participating in the back end of that kind of stuff. What was the first, and how did you get into community organization as I get past my side? And what was the first convention that you started?
Edited. Okay. So I lived in Knoxville, Tennessee, went there for college and then lived there for 11 years. And was there when started with the D&D Next playtest. We had a very active group of people. And then we were doing organized play in the stores. And we realized that like our city didn't have local coordinators. And therefore the local coordinators at that point in time were like the source to get the adventures and the certs and blah, blah, blah. And so my friend Jay, Anderson, was organizing at the big main store that we have on the east side of town, Sci-Fi City. And I had been working on the far west side of town and had decided that I was going to rope my coworkers into D&D. And there was a game store across the street from our office, but they didn't do D&D. So I went in there and told them that we were going to do D&D, and then asked which night would not be in the way. And then we were kind of doing D&D at two stores, and we didn't have a local coordinator. So Jay and I were like, well, we want to have the cool stuff for all the players because we're getting a lot of players now. So he and I applied to be local coordinators. And, you know, after some runaround trying to get in touch with the right people, we were made local coordinators. And then a couple months later, the regional coordinator for the Southeast departed to pursue other life goals, and they were taking open applications. And I'm like, what the heck, you know, let's try it. And so, you know, I put in my name and lo and behold, they chose me. So at that point in time though, I've gotten a little ahead of myself timeline wise, and I kind of stepped back to, you know, we'd been doing the thing in Knoxville and had gotten a pretty good community going between the east side of town and the west side. And some friends of mine that I originally started with had the idea to start this little event. You know, they're all getting together and playing games anyways. Why not raise money while we're doing it? Because we're all big on philanthropy. And so we started Save Versus Hunger. I wasn't involved in it the first year because it was all of four gaming groups, and I don't know where I was. I was busy or something. But then the second year, we got an actual event space at the food bank that we were supporting. And, you know, Jay and I were fully into the local coordinator thing. And he's like, okay, so you want to help with the AL? So I started organizing the Adventurers League there. And that was the first convention that I was fully involved with. And I still do that one to this day. And then it kind of just like, after I became a regional coordinator specifically, it kind of just snowballed quickly.
Then people are coming out of the woodwork. They want you to do things. It's like, hey, you kind of know what you're doing here. Help us with this. Help us with that.
Well, I mean, they were coming out of the woodwork, but mostly because I was going around knocking on all of the trees.
Okay.
As the regional coordinator, like when I came on, there were 9 local coordinators for the entire Southeast region. So for people not super clear on what region that is, that's everything from Missouri over to Virginia, down to Florida, and then back over to Louisiana. It's a huge territory. Mm-hmm. Landmass, it was the biggest territory. And there were 9 people covering it, which, in my opinion, did not cover it. So I started recruiting hard for passionate people who didn't seem to want to have the title just to have the title, people who like really cared about growing the community. And got all of the game stores in the region, all their contact information, and either like assigned a local coordinator to them if I had someone in that region, or if I didn't, like that was me picking up the phone, calling them, hey, have you heard the good news about Adventurers League? You know, going out there, spreading the gospel word,
yeah,
as it were. And so, you know, then people had my contact information as, you know, my regional coordinator contact information, not my phone number.
Right.
And so, you know, they would call me. They'd be like, hey, we thought we'd start a little convention because we're getting a lot of, you know, a lot of interest in like, we don't really have enough space to like have everyone here for game nights. But like, if we do a little thing, rent a little space for a day, like that counts as a convention, right? I'm like, yeah, totally does. So then like lots of regional conventions, small ones, kind of helping them do whatever. And then I got tagged in to help with MomoCon because every single one of my local coordinators in Atlanta, I had 4 vacations for Memorial Day, which was news to me. I didn't know that. Yeah. Memorial Day weekend is when MomoCon is, and they were desperately seeking someone. And I was like, I can't afford to drive 3 hours to Atlanta, stay in a hotel, and work the show. And they're like, you know, what do we need to give you in order to make this happen? And so, you know, hotel and all that covered. Mm-hmm. I went down and did it. And yeah, I was still doing MomoCon, 50,000 plus attendees. And I'm the RPG director for that now. So that's my biggest one. That's my my oldest child, I guess. Although not technically the oldest. From there, you know, I don't know how to say no. I do know now. I didn't know how to say no. And people would ask and I would just do, you know, help with their shows. And then I moved to Chicago and started helping with a charity convention up there. And at some point during all of that, I had gotten just really involved with the convention circuit. I went to a convention and it was just like love instantly. Like, these are my people. My first convention, by the way, was Dragon Con, because, you know, go big or go home.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's, I mean, it's, there's something special about conventions and playing Dungeons and Dragons at conventions with some people that you may know and some people that you may not. Why do you think, you talked about going to a convention and just finding your people. Why do you think that is? Why are conventions such a unique place to play Dungeons and Dragons?
Well, I mean, conventions are a unique place to Dungeons and Dragons because you get the opportunity to play with people you either see a couple of times a year at conventions, your con friends, or you get the opportunity to make new con friends, right? When I'm at a convention, my friends tell me that I can't possibly meet a stranger. I don't know the meaning of the word. You are now my friend, which is kind of true, unless you are egregiously an asshole. But I think that's one of the things, like, you get that opportunity to sit down with people that you don't know, to see their perspective on it, to play an entirely different game than what your home group does, and to play, like, be part of a big experience while you're doing that. And there's a huge draw to that, especially for people who might not have, like, a steady home group. You know that you can go to a convention and there are going to be people you will play.
Yeah, it's... there are still people that I think about. So I was active in D&D in the early 2000s during Living Greyhawk. And then I took a break and then I became enmeshed in the Adventures League. There are still people I think about from Living Greyhawk days, wondering where they went, because there was no Facebook. It's not like you could connect with people between cons. They would come up to Toronto where I lived. I would go to New York and see them there. I would go wherever, wondering what happened to them. I managed to reconnect with one of them. So
it's, you'd have to get their mailing address in the old days,
right? Like, what are you going to do? Write them a letter saying, hey, my guy has played APL 12. Like,
I have a D&D pen pal.
Do you really? Mm-hmm. Where are they located?
They're located in Atlanta, and we send postcards, little stickers and whatnot, back and forth, just talking about, like, cool things. And
that's lovely. Yeah, that's lovely. I'm curious about, you've done a lot of cons now, as I think everybody who's listening is going to get that impression. Can you pick a memory from a convention that really sticks with you? Something interesting or unexpected that might have happened, or a person you really enjoyed meeting that you hadn't met before?
Now, are we talking, like, specific to gaming? Do you want to narrow it down to that?
If you want to narrow it down to gaming, sure. But if there's something that's con related that is supersedes any of your gaming memories, that's cool too.
I mean, it's not a different kind of memory. So one of my most awkward fangirl moments as far as a gaming convention goes was the first Gamehole Con in Madison, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. that I went to. Ed Greenwood was on the guest list, so I took my little novel with me and I'm gonna get it signed. And I finally find Ed, and I'm there, and he's talking to people, and I'm standing there, and then I'm just like, I didn't want to interrupt him. So I never got my book signed. Like, he was there, he was talking, and I was waiting, and then, like, he started walking away, and, like, I was like, do I want to follow him? No, that feels really stalkerish. And then, like, I talked to him years or so later, and he was like, "Dear Lord, why didn't you just interrupt me? I don't stop talking. You know that, right?" And I'm like, "I do know that now."
He's absolutely one of the most delightful human beings on the face of the earth. I've been lucky enough to, so we're going to talk about your charity endeavors a little bit more later in the interview, but as a part of our quest for the cure here at Fort Nerd, he's one of the players who's helped us raise $20,000 since September. So
Oh, nice. Yeah.
He's just a joy.
He's absolute delight.
Now the pandemic has changed how we play D&D and how we interact with each other. You've worked now, obviously, you've worked extensively at in-person events, and you've done lots through Baldwin working on virtual conventions. What do you think are the merits of each, and what are some of the drawbacks?
So as far as virtual conventions go, my first foray into it was not actually a Baldwin Games event. Our in-person charity conventions that I host every year, so Save vs. Hunger and the D8 Summit, the one in Illinois, obviously, they occur in April. So they got canceled last year. And we were like scrambling because our charities, they're small local charities, they really depend on our money. And it's a food bank and a homeless shelter. Those were more important than ever. So we pivoted and in about 2 weeks, put together a 10-day long international all time zones, all game systems open event called May Day's 10 Day. And we were flying by the seat of our pants. But it went off really well. And then the next virtual event, I believe, was D&D Live, and then Celebration. And then we started into the virtual D&D weekends. And I mean, the biggest difference, obviously, is there's a lot more technology involved, and there's a lot more, you have to have like strict protocols for, like, if an in-person convention, somebody signed up to DM, and if they don't show up, you've got other DMs, and you could just like literally go grab one by their shirt and tug them over to the table, or just ask them nicely, and, you know, boom, done, solved. Online as an organizer, it's not quite that simple. If a DM doesn't show, you have to find another DM who's using the same platform, who already knows the adventure and has a room prepped, who is, you know, comfortable taking these five or six people last minute, knowing that they're going to have to set everything up really quickly. That way they can get the adventure run and still end on time. And then there's just a lot of teaching people the technology. Cause like most people weren't playing D&D online before this. So they're like, "I've heard of Roll20." That's it. That's where it ends. I've heard of it. And that's not to mention Discord. You have to teach them all Discord too. And it's just a steep learning curve coming onto it, but everyone has gotten pretty good at it now. So it's made things pretty smooth. And I guess the biggest thing as far as like online conventions right now is that there are so many, it's hard to compete, which is where me being part of Baldwin Games comes in, because they are the one monthly event sponsored by Wizards of the Coast. So like, we don't have to compete. We are the competition.
Yeah.
So brings its own issues or.
Right. Now, of course, we hope that the trajectory continues going down related to the pandemic. I know here in Canada, it's been up and down and up and down.
Mm-hmm.
We're hoping that it continues to go down and that maybe there's an end in sight to the pandemic. I know, especially in the United States, things are opening up a little bit with the amount of vaccines that are getting into arms. Do you think that when the pandemic ends, that the plethora of virtual D&D conventions will end as well? Why not?
Well, I know personally, Baldwin Games has plans to continue offering a side-by-side virtual component to any physical convention that we do going forward. We're also committed to continuing the virtual weekends throughout the end of the year and into 2022. And there are so many people globally that can't come to physical conventions because you have to kind of face it. D&D is a still, despite, you know, everyone's best hopes and things, it is still a very much US-centric game, especially when it comes to conventions. So there's this whole population that all of a sudden was able to join in, and like, we don't want to all of a sudden exclude them. Like, all of our people in, you know, the Pacific Islands, Australia, Europe, you know, throughout Asia, South America, and all of that, they all still want to play D&D. And the only way they could play D&D is by staying connected virtually. So I think it'll stick around because it's, I mean, no good business would just intentionally piss off a large new segment of their consumer base. So.
Especially with how globally the game has been succeeding.
Correct. And I think actually we'll probably continue to see growth in that as, you know, other countries kind of adopt it, because it's been slower to catch on in other countries because they might not have the same, like, you know, internet infrastructure and all. Like, I know we've had some issues with people from Brazil playing in games and not having a stable connection. But that would be different, you know, if like someone in Brazil was hosting a virtual event in Brazil for people there. You know, it's a little closer and less, I don't know. But yeah, I think we'll see more of it, and especially more internationally.
Okay. Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think the hybrid in-person online stuff isn't going to go away. I mean, I know Spencer, my roommate, who we both know, he runs Citadel Geek, and our population is now 55% non-Canadian and 45% Canadian. You know, we started running two tables a week. We got up to eight. And that's going to continue. We're going to do, when we can, in-person events, but we're also going to do online events to support all those new friends we made. So
I know a full quarter of our DMs for the most recent May Days weren't in the North America at all, neither Canadian nor US. Yeah. So that was pretty significant.
Yeah,
and that's just the DMs. I don't know where the players were.
We need to keep supporting those new friends from outside of our North American fortress, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
As I said off the top, you're also not just a community organizer. You're also an accomplished writer, a DMs Guild adept. You've contributed to multiple best-selling products, and you're well known for a bunch of Adventures League content that's been very successful and well-written. What was your first D&D writing experience, and why did you decide to start publishing your D&D content?
So the first thing I wrote was actually part of the CCC program, which at that point was convention created, and it's now community created, and now it's defunct and is Dungeon Craft. Mm-hmm. But was for a local convention in the Southeast. We want to circle back to that don't know how to say no part. It's important. And they wanted a trilogy of adventures, you know, to lure people in. And so I was working with some of my friends trying to get them connected with writers. And then they're like, we'd like you to write one. And I'm like, why? But, you know, I had written before in my life, not games, but like I'd written a lot of, you know, narrative fiction. And so I was like, I've read a bunch of Adventures League modules at this point in time. I'm familiar with the format. I'm familiar with the game. Sure, I think I can figure this out. I tried to write a mystery. Don't do that as your first game. Maybe not even as your second or third game. It's hard. Mysteries are hard. It's definitely not one I'm the most proud of, but it did offer me a lot of learning experiences on what not to do. It's also not terrible. I'm my own worst critic. People still buy it. They're still buying it. I don't understand.
I mean, that's the only feedback you need, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm happy they're buying it because every penny from that one goes to my charity, Save Versus Hunger, or to Second Harvest, which we support from Save Versus Hunger.
Right.
So, but yeah, from that, I wrote that one first, but the first thing I actually got published was a contribution I did to a collaborative project that Jeff Stevens put on, Encounters in the Savage Jungles, to go with the Chult book, you know, Tomb of Annihilation. And that actually came out first. Jeff runs a slightly, you know, more tight project management schedule than the other people I was working with. I mean, he just does. So that went out, and somebody on the internet, whose name I have forgotten, went through on their blog and did a thorough review of every single encounter in the book and gave it like a 1 out of 5, you know, 5-star rating. And he gave mine 5 stars. And I was like, my little heart just exploded with nerd love. And so, you know, that just kind of was like, after never wanting to see the adventure that I had written for the convention ever again in my life, I was done with it. Seeing that review and being him being like, you know, your narrative, it made me feel like I was there. I was like, oh, I guess I can write. So then I wrote another thing, and then I wrote another thing. Mostly originally was writing with the various conventions through that program. And then I eventually got invited to write through the Adventurers League program in season 8. So the Waterdeep season. And I got to write a time travel
Wrinkle in the Weave, right?
Wrinkle in the Weave. For everyone who didn't know the history of the Empire of Shun, they were probably a little confused because the first 3 adventures were in Waterdeep, and then all of a sudden we're in Shun.
I'm pretty sure I ran it 4 or 5 times one weekend at Breakout Convention in season 8. So,
yeah, no, it's, you know, there was a lot of hate initially, but that was just because season 8 was a drastically different format.
Yeah.
But outside of that, pretty positive feedback on, like, it is fairly open-ended. There's a couple of things that you need to do in the adventure. They need to learn these things. But outside of that, like, you're at a party, you're in Shun, you know, do whatever.
Yeah. For those who, for those who aren't familiar with the Adventurers League, it's just basically a shared set of rules in an organized play system whereby you can take your character, if you're playing in your hometown of Bogota, Colombia. Wait, is Bogota in Colombia? I think it's Bogota, Colombia. And you can go to Gen Con, Indiana, and play the same character with new friends. And from the 7th season to the season that Ginny's referring to, the rules changed somewhat substantially, and there were a vocal minority of folks who were very angry with that change. So just some of the
very vocal minority. They like to think that they were the majority.
Yeah. I don't think
they were not.
It's true. Yeah. What was your greatest writing challenge and how did you overcome it?
That's a good question.
Thank you.
I would almost say, you know, just like my gut instinct is to say with the season 8 adventure, because I had to learn the new format with everyone else, but no, I think probably the greatest challenge that I had was well, I don't actually know if I can talk about the project though. I got
of course, NDA. Everybody's got NDAs, they can't talk about stuff.
But I got asked to write a tier 4 adventure. And I mean, for anyone who's ever played tier 4, you know that your characters can do whatever they want. Just go bananas. You've got all these powers. You're, you know, near deities walking the realms. And so it's very hard to write for tier 4 because you want it to be suitably epic, but there's absolutely no way as a writer and a DM that you can account for every possible combination of player options that's going to present themselves. So some things are by default going to be trivialized. So trying to think of an interesting story to tell there and trying to make it challenging. I prefer to write for tiers 1 and 2. So that's levels 1 to 4 and 5 to 10 for people not with Adventurers League. Because you know a little bit more like what the players are going to do and what's actually a challenge for them. Once you get into tiers 3 and 4, so 11 through 16 and then 17 to 20, it gets harder to write because you can't possibly, know what players are going to do. But no adventurer survives first contact with players.
Yeah. And of course, you're also, so on the one hand, you want to make it challenging and epic, but on the other, you don't necessarily want to make their abilities redundant or feel trivialized, as to steal your word.
And like one thing, one option at higher levels to kind of level the playing field for monsters and players is to like drop an anti-magic zone. But then guess who's pissed off? Your wizard.
Yeah, or I know there was an adventure. Spencer was telling me, I don't remember what it was called. It doesn't matter, and I wouldn't share the name anyway, but where the enemy went first. Mm-hmm. And the guy who had plus 18 to initiative said, well, I got 36. Like, well, the enemy goes first. So on the one hand, from the module design perspective, I understand it. From the other design perspective, it's like, well, there's balance. Basically, what I'm trying to say is there's balances at tier 4 where you're trying to make it fun for everyone and let them be gods while at the same time trying to challenge them without destroying their characters.
Because the person with the plus 18 on initiative, if he goes first and just kills the big bad before he has a chance to act, then everyone's like, was that it?
Yeah.
Are we done now?
Well, that's a story that I don't think I've shared on this podcast. Spencer was running an epic. And my character woke up a dragon and then rolled 30 something on initiative and killed the dragon. But Spencer, as soon as the encounter started, maxed out the dragon's hit points. So technically, even though I would have killed him according to the module, knowing that I was playing, maxed out the hit points and I didn't get to kill him. So I still claim that as a one round dragon kill. Spencer says no, but he's a cheese weasel and I don't like him all the time. So obviously D&D is more popular now than ever, as we've talked about.
Yes.
What advice would you give to folks who are interested in publishing their work and getting their imagination out there?
If you're interested in just publishing and you have something, I mean, honestly, just do it. Write it up. There are some nice templates available on the DMs Guild that will help you format it in Word and make it look beautiful. If you want to put it on the DMs Guild, you can use all of the intellectual property. If you want to have a little bit more freedom in where you can sell it, you have to follow the OGL, of course, Open Gaming License, but then you could post it on DriveThruRPG. You can publish it wherever you want. Like, honestly, like just write something and publish it. That's the first step. And then decide whether you love it or hate it. You're more likely to hate it. It's, just statistically. And then write something else. You don't have to write long things. Just start small. Write a little encounter. Like, drop a little 500 word encounter or, a subclass. You've had this idea mulling around. You only need a couple of pages. Put it out there, put it for sale, and then put something else out there, put it for sale. That's it. Just do it. Now for anyone wanting to write something, and get involved with organized play, there's the Dungeon Craft program. And my advice there is still pretty similar. Read the Dungeon Craft rules and then literally just write something. Just do it. Like, you might not think it's great, but somebody is going to like it somewhere, or somebody is going to like part of it and be like, hey, this bit sucked, but this was great. And then you've learned something there. And literally just like the best way to learn is to just do it. It's honestly terrifying the first time you write something and you end up stressing over it and then you stare at it too much and then you never want to see it again.
Building on your design credits in September of last year, you started a podcast called The Designer's Den. You've interviewed some incredible creators, including Justice and Bill from Beetle and Grimm, our friend Josh Simons, Allison Huang, Fenway Jones, and more. Why did you decide to start that podcast and start chatting with creators and designers?
So it's actually a Twitch show, and I record it live because, right. Much like you, I don't want to edit it.
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
honestly, I decided to start it because I was out of work. I was looking for a job, but I was out of work, and so I was freelancing full time. And so I was like, I need something to fill my time, which was honestly why I started it. I wanted to talk to people. I wanted to learn from people. I had free time. I had been streaming on Twitch, Magic Arena. I like to talk. So, you know, you put all of that together and it's like, yeah, you know, it was kind of like a logical fit. I already had a podcast that I was doing with Paige Lightman, co-host the D&D Roundtable, which was previously hosted by James and Tricasso before we took it over.
Right.
So, you know, had some experience in like lining up guests and talking to people, and like podcasting, much like anything else, it's not as intimidating as it seems. You really just got to do it.
Yeah.
Rang up my good friend Jeff Stevens and was like, Jeff, do you want to be my guinea pig? And so recorded the first show with Jeff, and people were like, this is good. I like this format. And so I was like, okay, I'll do it again. Just recorded my 36th episode. So it is a weekly weekly Twitch show.
Yep.
I have talked to a lot of great people and probably talked to a lot more, and very much, you know, excited for every single person I get to talk to. I learned something new.
Now, I'm not going to ask who your favorite guest was, because from host to host, that's such a jerk move. But I will put you slightly on the spot and ask if any of your guests surprised you in any way. Did the conversation turn into a direction you didn't expect, or did they...
Always.
Oh, okay.
I think the subtitle is Designer's Den, talking D&D design and whatever tangents we come up with.
Nice.
And that's what I tell my guests at the beginning when I start. I'm like, so we're going to start with this product that you've picked out. We're going to talk about it a little bit, and then we're going to talk about general design philosophy. And then it's just going to be a free-flowing conversation. Wherever it flows, if you have a thought, let's go with it. Sometimes we end up talking about very little design. Like Jennifer Kretschmer and I spent the entire episode, which actually went pretty long. I think it was an hour and 15 minutes in total. After we talked about her original first thing, which was, I believe, the tabletop RPG safety kit. We then just started talking about like diversity, inclusion, accessibility in gaming, and just like a lot of the problems that had, you know, come up throughout, you know, her gaming career, mine, other people's stories that we had been related to. And we really just had like a really great conversation about like ways to improve the community, to make it more open to everyone, whether that be like, you know, people with disabilities, whether that be, you know, gender, race, age, whatever, you know, whatever the perceived barrier is. And that was great. And I've had some other ones where like, it's just weird. Like sometimes like where the conversation goes. I know, when I talked to, Matthew Whitby, we spent a lot of time, just talking about other creators. Because he also does a Twitch show and interviews creators. So we had a lot of conversation there, and it just, you know, kind of all over. Much like I didn't interview Spencer for my show. I interviewed him for a Baldwin Games show, but like that conversation just went way out into left field. Elbowed my microphone in excitement.
It was a good interview. It was worthy of being excited about. I watched it.
But yeah, I do other Twitch shows in addition to that as well. So I host or produced a couple of others. So I produce a show for Jeff Stevens, occasionally butt in as the voice of God to tell Jeff to read the questions from chat that I've sent to him on Zoom. Do the monthly Baldman Games HQ, which is an update on the show, some relevant topic, which is how Spencer got dragged into it. The relevant topic of what's it like organizing online? and then there's another Baldman Games monthly show, the Herald's Guild Office Hours, where we just talk about being a better DM, being a better player, being a, you know, a better person involved with the community, how to make right. yourself the best. And so, right. yeah.
Do you have a particular process that you use when you're preparing for these Twitch interviews, or do you just sort of go into it? And
so I set it up, each show ostensibly has two parts. So I ask my guests to provide a link or PDF copy, whatever, to a product that they really like. It could be something they worked on. It could be someone else's thing. It can be, it could be, you know, it really doesn't matter what it is, some product that they love. And then, so we start out the show, introduce them, and then we talk about, you know, we're going to talk about this product they love, you know, why do you love it? If they wrote it, what inspired you to write it? And, you know, things like that. What do you think the design process was on here? And then we just kind of transition into like, if they're a designer, like what's your general design philosophy, which is where we usually end up on tangents. Like, this is my inspiration. I have my friend Eric Garneau on, and he did this whole zine, and all of the adventures in it were inspired by music. So we went off on like talking about all these albums from these other bands that were, you know, featured, and like how influential they had been on other aspects of our lives. And like, but you know, the only part I structure is this is the product we're going to talk about because I need to read it.
Right.
Right. Other than that, just like, no. I ask at the beginning, is there anything you definitely want to cover? Is there anything you definitely don't want me to ask you about? And that's it. Other than that, just, you know, wing it.
Yeah, sounds about right. Now, you've talked a lot about the charity work you're doing with Save Versus Hunger and the DA convention and the sort of transition to May Days online. Why is it important for you to contribute so actively to charity?
Well, I have always been, you know, like a strong supporter of being philanthropic if you're able, mm-hmm. Because we all start somewhere. We're all the same humans, and everybody has a bad day now and then. There are too many people on this world who are one bad day away from not having a house to live in, food to eat, or whatever it is. And, you know, everyone deserves at least the basic, you know, shelter, food, water, you know. And so I've always contributed a lot. When I didn't have money, I was in college and whatnot, I contributed my time. I would go, I would work at the food bank. I would work at the kitchens, handing out dinners or whatever it is. And then as I've, you know, progressed in my life and my career, and now I have the means and less time. now I just, you know, I give money and offer opportunities for other people to also contribute monetarily, because a lot of charities, like especially like food banks, you give them like a bag of, you know, canned food, like that's great and all, but like honestly the money you spent on buying that canned food, like they could have gotten five times as much food. Like, give them the $5, they'll do more with it. And so, you know, as a gaming community, like that's the thing, that's the key word there, community. We are a community, and your community is only ever as strong as your weakest link. And so, you know, it's important that we keep our community strong. And that doesn't just include the gaming community. So we, you know, give back, support the area around us. And that's always been something that I've been passionate about. So small local charities. So that's why we do the food bank and the homeless shelter, because, you know, Walmart, Target, whoever has got United Way down, they don't need us. So because, you know, those people, if they have their basic necessities in life covered and they're not having to stress, like, then they have the opportunity to take a break and to do something fun for their and good for their own mental health, like sit down and play D&D. You know, they don't have to have a book. They don't have, they just need to get to the game. And then everyone, you know, and it's just that little joy in people's lives.
Why do you think D&D has become such an effective fundraising vehicle, especially over the last 2 years? Jaspers has done such a great job raising money. Obviously, May Days was quite successful. Why do you think that? Why do you think that is? What is it about D&D?
Well, I don't like to stereotype, but I'm going to for a moment. Nerds play D&D. Nerds are smart. We've been through life. We've gone to college. Most of us, we've gotten well-paying jobs, and you know, we've a lot of us started at the bottom. Like we weren't all born into rich families. And so like we have this newfound wealth and we're like, okay, first off, I can buy all the minis that I want. But then I still have all of this money. I exaggerate a little bit because people also have families and stuff, but you know, we're more likely to have, money to spend. And it's an excellent demographic to target for that, because we already all care, you know, show that we care about, you know, social interaction and everything. And part of having that community is, again, making sure that community is taken care of. So like we give, and we give generously, especially if you can get a large group of people together and you're giving to a charity that supports the kids. If you just start chanting for the kids, people just keep pulling out their wallets.
That's a great idea. I need to steal that for sure.
I think we got that from a Canadian. I think it was Canadian that started that chant at Game Hole Con.
Nice.
I mean, Madison's practically Canada.
More or less honorary Canadians for sure. So Ginny, where can folks find you? I know you said you run a podcast with Paige Lightman. You're producing multiple shows. Where can folks who want to follow you find you?
You can find me online. Literally Google my name if you can't think of any of the other things. But my website is just jennyloveday.com. That's GINNYLOVEDAY. That's my handle also on all of my social medias. It's my Twitch channel. It is not my Discord handle, but if you join the Baldwin Games Discord, or if you find my Twitch channel and join my Discord, then you can find me on Discord. I got tired of having to change my nickname, so I just set it to Jenny Loveday, she, her, and then it's got some numbers.
Yeah.
Pretty easy to find online. When we get back to conventions, you'll find me at most of the major conventions. I have a pretty full convention schedule. And if you live in the Midwestern area, currently residing in Michigan, was previously in Chicago, then you might find me at some small cons, or who knows? I don't know, at Walmart.
It sounds like you have been not practicing saying no, but so glad that we're going to have an opportunity to hopefully see you at some point in the near future.
Yeah, you can see me, we were going to go to Montreal last year, which isn't quite where you're at, but, it's Canada. Yeah. We do plan to get to Canada soon for some shows. We got a bunch of good friends up there. Hopefully over to Europe as well. I want to get to England, especially excited to get to England so that I can meet some of the other people on the team with Steamforged Games for the Animal Adventures product line, which I am super excited to be working on.
You launched a Kickstarter for that, right?
I didn't launch Kickstarter. They launched Kickstarter. I'm on the design team for the book. So if you like adorable animals and you want to be an animal adventurer, Look it up. It comes with minis.
I will be sure to drop the link for that in the show notes. Ginny, thanks so much for chatting with me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you again for having me on. This is absolutely a delight.
That's our show for this week. Thanks for listening. If you made it this far but haven't subscribed, I don't understand you, but I still love you. It's always good having you join me, and remember, if the die is cocked, it doesn't count. I look forward to chatting with you again next week.